Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Physicians for Healthy Communities, a physician-led organization that educates on the science of prevention to improve public health. Visit their website to learn how they prevent substance misuse while supporting individuals, families, and communities. Go to physiciansforhealthycommunities.org. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a dopaminergic conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Dopaminergic, as in full of dopamine. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter, a chemical that the brain cell uses to send signals to one another. You need dopamine to live. You need it like you need oxygen and water. And without it, you feel like you're dying. Dopamine is associated with pleasure or reward-motivated behavior. And many addictive drugs increase dopamine to a level much higher than even the most joyful events in life. For me, eating a Cadbury roast almond milk chocolate bar. My favorite, or the wedding day, or winning the lottery. Methamphetamine or winning the lottery? Well, methamphetamine can actually give you 1,000 times more dopamine than winning the lottery. If drugs are regularly used, the brain says, hey, I don't need to make my own dopamine. I'm already getting more than I need from the outside. And the brain decreases dopamine receptors and production. Now, the person using drugs is in a bind. You need dopamine to live. Your body is not making it, so of course you have to use drugs. Not to get high, but just to get out of bed, just to feel normal. It becomes a vicious cycle. The good news is the vicious cycle can be broken. Addiction can be treated. There's hope, but it takes time. To learn more about dopamine, I reached out to Dr. Anna Lemke. Dr. Anna Lemke is a professor of psychiatry at Stanford University School of Medicine and chief of the Stanford Addiction Medicine Dual Diagnosis Clinic. A clinician scholar, she is an author of more than 100 peer-reviewed publications, has testified before the United States House of Representatives and Senate, has served as an expert witness in the federal and state opioid litigation, and is an internationally recognized leader in addiction medicine, treatment, and education. She's author of 2 best-selling books, Drug Dealer MD, How Doctors Were Duped, Patients Were Hooked, and Why It's So Hard to Stop, and Dopamine Nature, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. I love the movie Social Dilemma, and there she was on the big screen, talking about mental health and addictive nature of social media. To learn more about Dr. Anna Lemke, check out the High Truth show notes. Dr. Anna Lemke, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm excited to be here.
I am excited. I've been following you for many years. Our paths kind of cross several times, and it's really great to finally see you kind of semi in person via Zoom. But let's start with having the audience get to know you a little bit. You're a physician, a psychiatrist. Why did you want to be a doctor?
Oh, gosh, the usual thing, you know, wanting to help people find meaning and purpose in my daily work life. Also, for a while there, I tried to get other jobs and I was essentially not employable. This was after having graduated summa cum laude from Yale. I remember I tried to get a job as a bank teller and they're like, no, you're overqualified. I mean, I just couldn't seem to find employment. This was after spending a year in China and, you know, learning Mandarin and teaching there. And I thought, oh, you know, I'm going to come back and I'm going to have all these skills. Turned out, not so much. So,
wow. So you could get a job as a doctor.
Yes, that was, I thought, where can I get a skill set that anywhere I go in the world, I'll be hopefully employable.
Yes. Well, you got that. And we have something in common. You did your internship at Highland Hospital. I did a rotation there, and that was a wild place.
You know, that was a highlight of my medical education. It's just such a fabulous place to get training. So many skilled clinicians, educators, a fantastic population of patients who really need and want help. That for me was really a great year.
It was. And then you decided to subspecialize in addiction medicine. How did you do that? Like, I grandfathered in with addiction medicine, with prevention medicine boards. Is that what you did?
Yes. So about 25 years ago, I had no intentions of treating addiction. I hadn't learned much about it in psychiatry, residency, or in medical school. I also came in with some of the usual prejudices that people with addiction are unhelpable, that it's not really a medical problem. I know that's hard for people today to imagine that a healthcare system would compartmentalize addiction as not a medical problem, but that really was in the 1990s when I went through my medical education. That was the thinking, that it was a social problem, that it was something that Hazelden and Betty Ford was going to take care of, not doctors. But then in my practice, I had one particular case of a patient who I'd been treating for a long time, nominally for depression. She came dutifully every week. We talked about every conversation she'd ever had with her mother. I prescribed her Paxil for depression. She would often nod off in the sessions and tell me it was because of Paxil. And I, being unknowledgeable and unskilled, didn't probe further and didn't know what nodding off looked like. Until, unfortunately, her brother called me and let me know that she'd been in a rollover car accident. I said, oh my goodness, that's terrible. What happened? He said, well, she's been using again. And I literally did not even understand the construct of the sentence. I said, using what? He said, using heroin. Isn't that what you've been treating her for? So it was one of these sort of moments of reckoning where I realized, oh my goodness, I'm actually a bad psychiatrist. And I'm harming my patient out of ignorance. And that here this whole time, her family was sending her here thinking she was getting help for addiction. And in fact, I wasn't helping her with the thing that she needed help with. And of course, it's not a patient's job to educate their provider, right? It's natural that a patient is not going to talk about stigmatizing behaviors like addiction, but a skilled clinician should know how to probe for that and ask for that. And I didn't have any of those skills. So that was really when I decided to change my focus to learning more about addiction, researching addiction, and trying to help my patients. And really, my career has just followed from there.
And you still treat patients. What's your patient population like?
I have a very mixed population of patients, from adolescents to people in their 80s, all kinds of different substances, and more people with behavioral addictions, gambling, sex, the internet in all its varied forms. So we have a very diverse set of patients. Most of them are insured or have a family member who's insured. Most of them are housed. So that's my outpatient population. I used to do inpatient hospital work too, but in recent years, I've given that up to my younger colleagues who are directing our inpatient consult service. I also lead an addiction medicine fellowship. So this is an additional year of clinical training focused on developing those skills in addiction medicine. It's an interdisciplinary fellowship, which means that any doctor who's completed any ACGME accredited residency in any specialty, from emergency medicine to pediatrics to family medicine to psychiatry, can apply to spend an additional year here with us at Stanford learning more about addiction.
That's great and important. We need more of that. You're also, in the top of all that, a best-selling author. And is that a passion that you have in writing?
Yeah, you know, I get that question sometimes. And I've always been a reader. I think readers are naturally, writers, just because people who like language and the written word and narrative, will write typically, but I never aspired really to be a writer or to publish a book. That wasn't really anything that I thought I would do. But at one point, mid-career, I realized that there were things that I felt I wanted to say and that people would benefit from knowing about, specifically about addiction, that I was never going to get published in a peer-reviewed medical journal just because it had to do with the nuances and the art of clinical care. It had to do with patients' lived experience and narrative. I mean, these are not things that typically have a home in peer-reviewed medical journals. So that's what inspired me to write my first book, Drug Dealer MD, about the origins and causes of the opioid epidemic. And then from there, because I felt I could reach a larger audience and that was gratifying, I thought, well, you know, I think I still have another book in me, something more to say. And that's when I wrote Dopamine Nation.
That's awesome. And it's really well written. I read Drug Dealer MD and I listened on Audible on Dopamine Nation, and both amazing. I'm really glad that I did the audios. I could like hear you in a very clear voice as well.
Thank you.
Drug Dealer MD, talking about how me and my colleagues in the 90s especially really were pushing opioids because that's what we were told to do. And I remember being one of the first to say, hey, this isn't right. I'm meeting these parents who are devastated. And yet we would, in the emergency department, we would see the people like, I know my rights and you need to treat my pain. And what are you going to do for me? Do you blame doctors for this, the initial opioid prescription epidemic?
I don't blame doctors. I mean, to some extent, we are responsible. But what I'm talking about in Drug Dealer MD, and I say this explicitly, is not actually so-called pill mill doctors who have lost their moral compass and are trading prescriptions for cash. The real drivers of the oversupply that of prescription opioids that caused the opioid epidemic was prescriptions written by nominally well-trained doctors who are actually trying to help people. The opioid epidemic is a quintessential example of a commercially driven epidemic. It came to being because commercial interests, starting with Purdue Pharma, but ultimately including many other players in the pharmaceutical opioid industry, used science and misrepresented science, a kind of pseudoscience, to convince doctors, patients, the medical community more broadly, that opioids were first-line treatment for all forms of pain, that a patient could not get addicted to opioids as long as they were being prescribed by a doctor in a medical setting, and that no dose was too high. If the patient presented with what looked like signs and symptoms of addiction, they were really pseudo-addicted, and the answer was to just go up on the dose to relieve their pain. And that, you know, began in the 1990s and really spiraled out of control in the early aughts, all the way till about 2012, which was the peak of opioid prescribing in the United States, after which, it became very clear that we were dealing with a pharmaceutically driven opioid epidemic. And it was in the media, and there were beginnings of lawsuits, and there were doctors themselves now, coming forward and saying, "Wait a minute, we've lost our way here." That opioid prescribing, thankfully started to trend downward more toward the level of medical necessity. I always want to emphasize that opioids are a very valuable tool. I'm really glad that we have them in our pharmacopoeia. The problem is when we overprescribe them and we overstate the benefits and minimize the harms, and then it becomes a public health issue.
Right. I remember in when I was in my residency, I was told, like, you in your profession, emergency physicians, are not doing enough to treat people pain. Right. And we really pushed to treat that. We used to give Tylenol number 3. I don't know if you're old enough to do that. And then they changed the law where, and then instantly overnight we were all doing Vicodin and oxycodone and got rid of the Tylenol number 3. So we immediately, it was like one pen of a legislative effort, prescribing practices, changed in California.
Oh yeah. I mean, you're highlighting one of the main ways that the opioid pharmaceutical industry, drove this home was essentially to say, we have a chronic pain epidemic, which, by the way, is true. We have an aging population, people living longer with serious chronic medical conditions, experiencing more pain. But then saying, and for our chronic pain epidemic, we should be prescribing more opioids. Opioids were never going to be the solution to our problem of pain in this country or really anywhere in the world because they don't work long-term for pain. There's no reliable evidence that opioids taken daily for pain are ultimately beneficial or more beneficial than Tylenol, which has fewer medication adverse effects. But essentially, doctors were guilted into prescribing opioids, even when they didn't think it was a good idea, because to withhold them became tantamount to causing pain.
Yes. And so we were able to really work on that. And I think it's important to study how we solved that problem, because I think that we solved it. We're not perfect. They're still underprescribing. They're still overprescribing. But the crisis is not there anymore. We have data that's showing we're at the lowest level of opioid prescription since we started tracking this with our PDMP monitoring systems. But we got to that by working on the supply and not making sure new people don't become addicted to opioids, and just kind of managing the people who are already on it for long term.
And yeah, exactly. I mean, I think we have come a long way. I wouldn't say we've solved the problem. I mean, one of the unintended consequences of decreasing opioid prescribing was that many individuals who had gotten addicted to opioids through a doctor's prescription then went to the street to access illicit sources, heroin, and now, of course, this explosion in deaths related to illicit fentanyl, which is so much more potent and so much more lethal. So our opioid overdose-related deaths, unfortunately, have skyrocketed as prescribing has gone down. But every policy will have unintended consequences. We need to now address our illicit fentanyl.
But the sheer numbers, because I think at the beginning of the whole fentanyl crisis, people using heroin and didn't get, you know, or people using prescription couldn't get it, you know, from their doctor, and they moved to heroin and later fentanyl. But the sheer number of fentanyl deaths show us this is not the doctor problem. I just don't like the doctor bashing, because we say, oh, it's all these physicians and the pharmaceutical industry that created the current fentanyl crisis. And a percentage of that is true, but the sheer number of deaths doesn't go with that. I mean, fentanyl is just, it's coming from the outside and affecting people. Not everybody who has a substance use disorder is dying from it. They're sometimes tricked or make a mistake. So I don't think at this point in time it's fair to say that, you know, that the current fentanyl crisis is driven by the medical community.
Well, I would agree with you that the physician prescribing and prescription opioids specifically are no longer the major contributor toward current opioid overdose death rates. But if you look at overdose deaths that are related specifically to prescription opioids, they've gone down, but kind of plateaued, honestly. And I would argue that the individuals who are now exclusively using heroin and illicit fentanyl, that was a cohort that was driven by the increased supply of those illicit sources because of the demand originally from individuals who had gotten addicted to prescription opioids. Now, of course, not exclusively. Through all of this, there have been individuals who have been using heroin and never used prescription opioids, right? It's a small amount. But I would say that we would not be in our current fentanyl crisis had it not been for the issue of prescription opioid overprescribing, oversupply.
And I don't know if that's true anymore. If I ask every single patient that comes to the emergency department through our Bridge program to get Suboxone, or anybody who overdosed or anybody uses drugs, I always ask, like, what's the first drug you ever used, or how, you know, tell me about your journey to addiction. A few years ago, it was prescriptions, but now I really don't get that. If the first drug they've ever used is marijuana.
Yeah, so I think I need to articulate this a little bit more specifically. What I'm trying to say is that the increase in supply of illicit opioids, including illicit fentanyl, came from the increase in demand originally. Now, most individuals who are initiating opioid use don't start with a prescription opioid, right? Who are using, misusing it. Mm-hmm. So yes, we're dealing with a totally different wave of the opioid epidemic. But I think this third wave of illicit fentanyl derives originally from the opioid oversupply, if that makes sense. It's a nuanced distinction.
I think the nuance goes to your next book, The Dopamine Nation. Like, we want this, right? There was a subgroup of people who, you know, when we were trained to, like, overprescribe opioids. So we had that population. But the whole premise of, like you say in your book, of seeking pleasure and wanting to cover up any pain and using whatever means, prescription or illicit drugs, is one of the ways to do it.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. I mean, in general, all drugs are more accessible than they ever were before. Our global supply chain and our technology and innovation and, you know, assembly line production, whether in a legal setting or an illegal setting, means that really you can get potent drugs anywhere in the world. You know, there really is no place to go anymore where you can hide from drugs. Plus, of course, we've drugified every other aspect of our lives by making even behaviors that we typically think of as healthy, like games or human connection, we've turned them into drugs. We've made them more potent, more novel, more bountiful, more accessible, all of which increases the, you know, addictive potential to things that we never even thought of as drugs.
So, Anna, are you Team Edward or Team Jacob?
Oh, my gosh. I've really always been Team Edward. Okay. How about you?
Vampires or werewolves in Twilight? It's just, I read that in your book, and that you talk about your addiction of romance novels. And I wasn't either. I read all the books because my daughter was reading them, and she was a Twilight fanatic. And interestingly, now that she's a doctor, she's reading a lot of romance novels, and it made me worry.
I know. This is kind of one of the problems. Like, we don't want to, you know, it's not like about fear mongering, right? And to make everyone, oh no, am I addicted to this? Am I addicted to that? Like, but the point really is, again, that we've come to a point in civilization where we've taken the novel. So let's just use that as the example here. And we really have cracked the code on hijacking our motivational reward system, even when it comes to something like a book, right? The books are much more page turners, right? I can go to 3/4 of the way through any romance novel and get right to the point, pun intended. And as I was getting addicted to romance novels, facilitated, by the way, by the Kindle, and Twilight was my gateway drug, I got to the point where I was just became a chain reader. Like, as soon as I finished one, I was on to the next. I looked for free romance novels on Amazon, because every good drug dealer knows that free samples are the way to get your customer base. I got to a point where, as soon as I got to 3/4 of the way through, I wouldn't even finish. I would just close the book and go on to the next one, because I was looking for the high, right? And I wouldn't worry about your daughter necessarily, but what it does speak to is there's an intense need to escape reality today, which is really fascinating and puzzling. Because, like, we live in a more comfortable, rich, in many ways, like, bountiful in all of these things that you would think of as what makes up for a good life, you know, education, you know, just all these wonderful things. And yet we're always trying to escape ourselves and kind of go into this fantasy world. And I just think that that's fascinating.
It is. And you make a point of that in Dopamine Nation. And we've heard that, you know, in happiness surveys, like, we are, you know, a first world country. We have everything. We're bountiful, like you said. And yet we're not a happy country.
Right. Yeah.
And you see really poor countries, you know, I was born in Israel. It's war, and you see all bad things on the news. It's a happy country. The citizens are happy. They have a goal. They rate higher on the happy scale.
Yeah. So this is really fascinating. And basically, these happiness surveys, how do they work? People are just asked to rate their happiness on a scale from 1 to 10. 1 is not very happy. 10 is very happy. And since these surveys have been done. Typically, the trend prior to the year 2000 was that as countries became wealthier, people got happier, which is, you know, what you would expect, right? People living in poverty, you would think, are generally going to be less happy than people who have wealth. But starting in about the year 2000, we reached some kind of tipping point where happiness surveys started to go down in the richest countries in the world, to the point now where today, where in many people living in wealthy nations rate themselves as less happy than people who live in socioeconomically distressed and even potentially war-torn nations. Also, we're seeing rising rates of anxiety and depression all over the world, and those rates are going up fastest in the wealthiest nations. Keeping in mind that these are also the nations that have the most access to psychotropic medications that treat depression and anxiety, and other forms of what we consider to be state-of-the-art mental health treatment, which, you know, as I talk about in Dopamine Nation, suggests that we're getting something fundamentally wrong about mental health. And that, in fact, maybe this pursuit of pleasure, this escaping pain, this trying to make ourselves more and more comfortable is not, in fact, the way for us to be happier.
I thought that the nation study, that the nations or places where that scale higher in the happiness score, the citizens have more pride in their country and more purpose for their lives. And they feel that purpose.
Well, generally, we know that people who have a sense of meaning and purpose in their lives are happier than people who don't. I don't know about any specific research linking the happiness surveys to, you know, directly to meaning and purpose in those countries, but, you know, I believe it. It makes sense.
So one of the things you talk about is usually we're thinking about we want to pursue happiness, pursue pleasure, anything that's good, do whatever it is that makes you happy. But you have a concept of pursuing the pain.
Right.
So tell us about that.
Yeah. And so really that comes out of, you know, clinical experience, observation, but also importantly, some exciting findings in neuroscience showing that pain and pleasure are co-located in the brain. And kind of work like opposite sides of a balance, what we talk about as an opponent process mechanism. When we feel pleasure, we tip one way, pain, we tip the other. And that it is the, you know, overwhelming physiologic drive of all living organisms to restore a level balance, or what neuroscientists call homeostasis. And interesting research has shown that the way that we restore a level balance is first by tilting an equal and opposite amount to whatever the initial stimulus was. So if we do something that's pleasurable, that releases dopamine, our pleasure neurotransmitter, and our reward pathway, our balance tips to the side of pleasure. No sooner has that happened than our brains want to restore a level balance. And they do that by downregulating dopamine transmission, postsynaptic dopamine receptors in the reward pathway, not just to baseline, but actually below baseline into a dopamine deficit state. I imagine that is these little neuroadaptation gremlins hopping on the pain side of the balance to bring it level again, but they like it there, so they stay on until the balance is tilted an equal and opposite amount to the side of pain. That's the come down, the hangover, the blue Monday, or that moment of craving, right? Wanting to have one more piece of chocolate, watch one more TikTok video, have one more glass of wine. Now, if we, you know, surf the urge and wait out that craving, those neuroadaptation gremlins hop off, dopamine levels go back to upregulate, back to baseline, and we're back at a homeostasis. But if we continue to consume our drug of choice over days to weeks to months to years, which, by the way, is very easy to do in this world of plenty, we eventually accumulate so many neuroadaptation gremlins on the pain side of the balance that we end up in a chronic dopamine deficit state. And that's the addicted brain, right? We've essentially changed our hedonic or joy set point. Now, more modest pleasures are not pleasurable because they don't outweigh those gremlins on the pain side of the balance. And we need more and more potent forms and higher amounts of our drug of choice, not to get high, but just to level the balance and feel normal. And that's, you know, the classic cycle that you hear in addiction. It's not about pleasure anymore. It's about not being in pain. I hate this drug, but I can't stop using it, that type of thing.
But when you say pursue the pain, I think about it kind of like exercise, no pain, no gain.
You're right. I didn't really respond to that piece. So this pleasure pain balance works in the opposite direction, right? So if we intentionally press on the pain side by doing things that are just the right size of amount of pain, not too much and not too little, we essentially trigger those gremlins to hop on the pleasure side of the balance, and we get our dopamine indirectly by paying for it up front. And what's essentially happening is that our body is registering injury and then upregulating feel-good neurotransmitters and hormones in response to injury. So the classic example is the runner's high, right? It turns out that exercise is immediately toxic to cells, but we all know exercise is healthy. Why is that? Well, a lot of different reasons, but one of the reasons is that it upregulates dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine, our endogenous opioid system, our endogenous cannabinoid system. Those are all the things that make us feel good. So I get that post runner's high and I essentially do it without accumulating gremlins on the pain side of the balance, right? I press on the pain side first, the gremlins hop on the pleasure side, and then I go back to homeostasis. So that's very nice because it's less vulnerable, although not invulnerable, to this cycle of intoxication, withdrawal, craving, and then compulsive overuse.
So when you talk about pursue the pain, does it also apply to somebody who has an addiction and now in order to get off of it, you may feel some withdrawal?
Yeah. So just stopping our drug of choice means that we have to allow ourselves to experience the pain of withdrawal. There's really not any way around that. So just tolerating that uncomfortable feeling. Although interestingly, people who are in withdrawal, people with severe addiction in withdrawal, who exercise during that withdrawal period have mitigated withdrawal symptoms. So again, as we take the pleasure off of the pleasure side of the balance, those gremlins that accumulate on the pain side crash us down to the side of pain. It turns out if we press harder on the pain side of the balance as we're withdrawing, that triggers those gremlins to hop off. So by doing that hormetic or challenging, painful, difficult thing during withdrawal, we can speed up the process of restoring homeostasis or baseline healthy dopamine firing.
Yeah. And one of the phenomenons, I don't know if you've seen patients like that. I saw a lot of patients like that a few years ago, not so much anymore, are the ones with opioid hyperalgesia, where they've taken so much opioids, they've really messed up their neurotransmitters and the opioid pathway that they are actually feeling more pain. That I would just barely put my stethoscope on them and they'd be like, ow, 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 ow.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that was really a revelation, you know, in the early 2000s to see these patients with terrible pain syndromes who had been put on enormous doses of opioids, who now were in more pain, including in parts of their body, that they had never had pain before. And that was that realization of the neuroscience, right? That when you use something like an opioid or any addictive substance or behavior, the drive toward homeostasis means that the brain is going to stop making our own endogenous opioids, stop making our own dopamine. We're going to end up in this paucity of endogenous opioids, endogenous. And now we're essentially, again, in that allostatic brain where we've had to end up in this dopamine deficit state. And that's exactly what happens with people with addiction. People, for example, who say, cannabis used to help my anxiety, now it makes me paranoid, right? So where the drug stops working, where it turns on us, and now our immediate response is the painful part with none of the good part. And that's, again, the way that the brain has adapted and changed in response to chronic use.
It's interesting that you said that with cannabis for anxiety, because I felt like people are just covering up their withdrawal, because the withdrawal from at cannabis is anxiety. So they say, I need it for my anxiety. It's like, but that it's you actually covering up your withdrawal. And I see a lot of people don't understand that, oh, when they say, well, I'm self-medicating, which is a term, I don't know how you feel about it, but I think as a physician, I really don't like the word to self-medicate. First of all, it's not a medicine. It's not an FDA-approved drug. And for you to, you know, if you're actually harming yourself, better to say you're covering up your pain to give it legitimacy that, well, I'm just self-medicating.
Yeah. So I published a couple papers on self-medication, I think more than 15 years ago now, because almost every patient that came in was saying, oh, I'm not addicted. I'm just self-medicating my anxiety, my depression, my insomnia. I think what's valid and true about that experience is that initially many people do turn to drugs as a way to treat an underlying psychiatric symptom. And initially, like very early on, it may actually help. You know, otherwise people wouldn't do it again. The problem is that over time, the brain adapts, it stops working, the gremlins accumulate on the pain side of the balance. And then what was initially a solution becomes its own problem. And now we're using the substance not to solve the problem, but actually just to medicate withdrawal from the last dose. So for example, patients will come in and patients who have struggled with benzodiazepines like Valium and Xanax and who've been able to get off of them. And then they say, but I'm still having anxiety. You know, wouldn't you prescribe? And I said, you know, if I were to prescribe you a benzo, it would definitely work the first or second, or maybe even the 10th time you took it. But over time, I would just give you a new problem, which is that you would become physically dependent on it. And then you would need it to stave off withdrawal. And I don't want to do that to you.
Yeah. And it's not easy to say as a doctor. I think a lot of doctors will be like, oh, whatever, you know, it's harder to say no than it is to say yes. But yeah, I'd say like, I don't want to make you worse. I'm not going to, you know, because patients are like begging and threatening to get their medications. And
yeah, well, I mean, yeah, it's, you know, they're suffering and, you know, medicine holds out a lot of high expectations and promise of what it can do. I wish medicine as a field would emanate more humility about what we can actually help with and the limits of modern medicine.
Yeah. You know, what we're seeing now, I don't know if you're seeing these patients, the ones that are similar to the opioid hyperalgesia syndrome. You mentioned the anxiety with the cannabis, but we're seeing the cannabis hyperemesis syndrome. That really reminds me, and I think it maybe even be the same pathway where you have much marijuana for so many years and you're doing it to help your appetite and to help, you know, and then I see these skinny patients who've been using marijuana for years and they said, but I need it for my appetite, but they're there throwing up to a horrid level. And it's because of the marijuana use. And then again, just like opioid hyperalgesia, the treatment for that is less opioids. And the treatment for cannabis hyperemesis syndrome is stopping marijuana, which is not easy to do because de facto, every patient with cannabis hyperemesis syndrome has a cannabis use disorder.
Well, it is the same opponent process mechanism, right? So people initiate cannabis often to help with nausea and problems with appetite. And initially it works. Again, I feel it's really important to validate that people wouldn't return to use unless it actually solved a problem. But then you have the same phenomenon, neuroadaptation, the opponent process mechanism, gremlins accumulating on that pain side of the balance, which includes then developing exactly more of the problem that they were trying to combat in the first place, right? They start having violent cyclical vomiting. And it's because of the cannabis. And then our intervention is, you know, you need to stop the cannabis. And when they first stop, the vomiting gets worse. And that's why I think it's so important to communicate to patients, yes, it will get worse before it gets better, but it's time limited. It's withdrawal mediated. If you can just continue to abstain for 10 to 14 days, by weeks 3 and 4, you should notice a lessening of the vomiting. And if you can stay off for the long term, the vomiting might actually completely go away. So this is where, you know, a lot of coaching is required.
I think we have a real gap for the medical community in that. I've heard emergency physicians say, we'll just use edibles instead, which are more potent and less predictable. Yeah. And trying to do a harm reduction approach is instead of what I tell patients, it sounds like you do the same. I say, give your body a cleanse. Just try it. Yeah. And it'll be harder. If you could make it through these 2 weeks, you'll do better.
Absolutely. I often use the word experiment. I say, let's do an experiment. You have the sense that cannabis or alcohol or opioids or romance novels or shopping or video games is helping you. And that you would be worse off without it. So let's do an experiment. Let's have you stop that behavior for 30 days, anticipating that you will feel worse before you feel better, because when you take the weight off the pleasure side, the gremlins will smash you down to the pain side. That's withdrawal. And if you can just make it to about 3 or 4 weeks, my hypothesis is that those gremlins will hop off the pain side of the balance, homeostasis will be restored, and you will feel better than you have in a very long time. And when patients are willing and able to engage in that project, about 80% of them report exactly that, a huge improvement in the very symptom that they were trying to target with that substance or behavior, whether it was a sleep disturbance, a mood disturbance, a cognitive problem, an anxiety problem, what have you.
What about using medications? We all know, and you know, training the rest of the medical community to use Suboxone for opioid withdrawal and opioid addiction. There's also naltrexone for alcohol. I don't know how much medications you're using for addiction, but people say, well, can you give me something for sleep? Or can I at least have something for anxiety? Or are there medications to help people when they're going through withdrawal from cannabis, for say, you know, we have tapers for, and actually, you know, we sometimes admit patients to the hospital because of alcohol withdrawal and even opioid withdrawal. But some things are more subtle and patients ask for, well, I need something for sleep. I need something for anxiety. Can you give me something to help me deal with the withdrawal? Opioids aside, because we do have medications for that.
Yeah, so I'm really excited about the medications that we currently have, the medications that are coming down the pike. I wish there were more innovation in this area. In general, you know, we try to prescribe evidence-based medications, but we do also use the evidence that supports off-label use of medications. We make a big distinction between the initial withdrawal period and then the maintenance period, the long-term recovery of addiction. As you say, you know, with acute withdrawal from opioids or alcohol or benzodiazepines, in severe cases that requires medical monitoring, sometimes some very powerful medications that mimic the drug itself as a way to help people get off. Or with severe opioid use disorder, acknowledgement that even with sustained abstinence, some people may still end up with a pleasure-pain balance tilted to the side of pain. They may not have the neuroplasticity to actually restore full homeostasis, in which case something like opioid agonist therapy, methadone maintenance, or buprenorphine may be a lifetime medication, and that's evidence-based. You know, and then for sort of to help with the signs and symptoms of withdrawal, we try to use non-addictive sedatives or anxiolytics, antidepressants, antipsychotics to help people through that period. Although I will say we have seen such improvements in depression, anxiety, and cognition with abstinence alone that if people can abstain for 30 days without using those psychotropics, we like to see how good they look, because very often they look so good that they don't actually need medications to treat the so-called underlying anxiety depression, that just simply stopping their drug of choice is all they needed to do in order to have resolution of those psychiatric symptoms. And then I will add that the GLP-1 modulators are a really exciting new frontier for helping with appetitive control, not just for food, but also things like alcohol, which is carbohydrate mediated. And there are some very interesting case reports that the GLP-1 agonists, this is things like Wegovy and Ozempic, not to, you know, put any brand names out there, but just this class of drugs may actually help with things like gambling and with sex addiction. You know, we're very early. We need much more evidence. But I think we have created a world in which it's very difficult not to be addicted, right? We've made everything more reinforcing, more accessible, yeah, more potent. So we need medicines that help us with appetitive control.
That's to get off. What about dealing with withdrawal, the sleep? Like, I'm afraid of giving you a sleeping pill when you're addicted to cannabis or benzodiazepines because you're just going to get another addiction.
Well, first of all, you know, when people are struggling with something like benzodiazepines and they're stopping them or lowering them, there's really no other sleep aid that's going to work except for another benzodiazepine. So I just say to people, like, we can try low-dose antidepressants that are sedating. We can try some atypical antipsychotics that are sedating. But really, you're going to have to struggle with insomnia. Same thing with alcohol, right? So again, looking to non-addictive, non-habit-forming adjuncts as nudges while acknowledging that they probably are not going to work very well, especially in withdrawal. And I really counsel patients here. We have studies showing that after people have been using alcohol chronically and heavily for many years, it can take up to 18 months for sleep to normalize. But eventually, for most people, it does normalize. So just a lot of reassurance, counseling a lot of patients, tincture of time, your sleep will get better the longer you can go without using. But, you know, for patients who really have terrible insomnia or persistent depression or persistent anxiety, we absolutely do use non-addictive medicines to try to help with those conditions as people continue to try to abstain from and be in recovery from their drug of choice.
Right. And a non-addicting, I hope you don't mean like Ambien, because I see so many people addicted to Ambien.
Yeah, Ambien is basically, it works on the same receptors as alcohol and benzodiazepines. You know, it's a scheduled drug, which means it's been recognized as being addictive. So I classify Ambien with the benzodiazepines, essentially. Yeah,
I've seen people come just begging for it in the emergency department. Abstinence or medications, I guess that's the balance, you know, that you practice in medicine. But do you try with your patients more of abstinence and trying to be off? Or what we see now in the United States is, oh, well, harm reduction. Let's just use, but use safer.
You know, I think we have to meet patients where they are, both what they're willing to do, what kind of care they have access to, what their insurance will pay for. You know, if an intervention really does reduce harm related to use, of course I'm in favor of it. But I think of harm reduction as a stepping stone to treatment. So I think addiction is a disease. I think addiction does not constitute a life worth living. By definition, it's a form of psychopathology and suffering. And so the idea is to get people in recovery from addiction. And any way we can do that, I'm in favor of.
We also talk about, we kind of hit about this, about cross-addicting contaminants. And kind of like you're saying, like if we put you on Ambien for your sleep while you're addicted to alcohol or benzodiazepine, then very likely you'll be addicted to the Ambien. We have to be very careful of that. Yes. I have a person who told me that they were having terrible time withdrawing from alcohol and they couldn't get the medical help that I know is available. But they ended up treating themselves. I won't call it self-medicating because I don't like the term, but they used marijuana and that helped them. And I said, well, I'm glad that that helped you, but that should not be a public health policy for others.
Yeah, I mean, these are exactly the questions that we're asking now, right? So, for example, when cannabis was originally legalized for recreational use in Colorado, it happened to correlate with a decrease in opioid overdose deaths, raising the question of whether or not that was a causative phenomenon.
Wait, but that article, I'm familiar with what you're saying, ended up being fake news because they took the same data and extended it by time and got the absolute opposite effect.
Right. So, yeah, I was getting to that. No worries. Not only that, there were a number of other extensive studies done in Australia and other places showing that. So the claim that was made, just for viewers who aren't, listeners who aren't familiar with this, was that, oh, by making cannabis dispensaries legal and accessible, we could combat the opioid epidemic because then chronic pain patients would switch from opioids, which are lethal, you know, it's easy to die from an accidental overdose, to cannabis. And it's very hard to like actually die from a cannabis overdose. There are a lot of negative side effects, but typically it's not death unless there's a psychosis that leads to some kind of injury accident. But later, further exploration and deep dive into that phenomenon, as well as specific testing of that very question, revealed that patients who are on high dose opioids, for their chronic pain, who then initiate cannabis as a way to get off of those opioids, end up on high dose opioids and high dose cannabis without any improvement in their pain. And that's certainly what we have seen clinically in our patients who come in and say, well, should I, you know, start cannabis because that will help my pain? Maybe I can get off opioids. We say, you know, we really don't recommend that, because the same phenomenon that happens with opioids, where they initially work for pain but then stop working and then make pain worse, is probably happening with cannabis. Initially, it might be helpful, but over time,
I definitely see that as an emergency physician, that people who have, you know, people have different responses to pain for the same injury. that the, you know, let's say trauma victims, the ones who are used to taking cannabis, have a harder time dealing with their pain. Or if they have surgery, you have a hip replacement, if you're used to taking cannabis, afterwards you have a harder issue with that, you know, same surgery as somebody who doesn't use drugs, you're going to have a harder time with managing your pain.
Yeah. I mean, the bottom line is we actually don't have good medicines for chronic pain. So for pain that lasts most of the day, every day for more than 3 months, which is beyond the time of normal tissue healing, which is how we define chronic pain, we don't really have good medicine. It becomes a centralizing pain disorder where the central nervous system basically just never shuts off the alarm about the somatosensory experience.
But luckily, we have less patients like that because we dialed down our prescribing habits. So we have less people getting into that situation.
I think we have fewer patients who are getting on chronic high-dose opioids for chronic pain. And that's the good news. I'm not sure we have fewer patients with chronic pain. I mean, I think chronic pain is still a huge problem.
Yeah. Social Dilemma, the movie, that was really interesting. It's a great movie on Netflix. And then at the very end, I get to see you in it. That was awesome. And what was striking at the very end of the movie, they asked all these, you know, Google, Facebook folks, do you let your children be on social media? And they all was like, no, no, no. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, let your child, like once your kids get to be teenagers, I just find they're going to do what they're going to do. And that makes it very challenging for parents, which is why I've been a huge advocate of saying, hey, we can't just leave this up to parents. This has to be the responsibility of schools, of communities, of corporations that make and profit from these social media platforms, of governance. Like, this is really a communal problem. You know, for us personally, we had very much of a Luddite household when our kids were little. We didn't even have Wi-Fi to the house. Our kids did not have their own computer or internet access devices. But when our eldest daughter started high school, she basically came home and said, hey, I need Wi-Fi to the house to do schoolwork. And she was absolutely right. Everything had gone online. And then a week later, she said, hey, I need a phone to be a socially adjusted teenager. And that's where we drew the line. And we said, no, we don't think that's true. So what did she do? She went out and bought her own phone. She paid for her own plan. And, you know, there it was. And so I think that's the reality. When our kids are little, we have certain degree of control. But once they get older, it has to be about the communal approach and just talking about, gee whiz, you know, what kind of relationship do we want to have with this technology? What is appropriate digital etiquette? And how can we enjoy all of the wonderful fruits of this amazing innovation without, you know, the dark underbelly of very obvious harms with overuse?
Yeah, and that's why I'm such a proponent of primary prevention, because as an emergency physician, I see downstream all the harms and right, I'm at the very end, you know, doing CPR, pronouncing someone or reviving someone after an overdose. I've heard several experts say that addiction is a pediatric disease, that we need to really address this early with primary prevention. Not just to use drugs, but how do we deal with anxiety and the difficulties that life gives us and the challenges without going to drugs?
Yeah, that's the major question, isn't it? Let me just say, shout out to pediatricians. We have two pediatricians in our addiction medicine fellowship this year. It's very exciting. Primary prevention is key. And part of that is, as a culture, how do we reframe our orientation on pain and suffering? Because we do have these cultural tropes that if you are unhappy or suffering, there's something wrong with you and everybody else is happy and you're not. That's a brain problem or a you problem, instead of saying, hey, that's a life problem. And what can we do as communities to help each other struggle through the pain and suffering that just is the nature of being alive?
There's a new medication. You talked about several innovations that you're excited about. One that I'm excited about is a drug called CS1103. It's a sequestrant. It's a drug that sequesters methamphetamine, also fentanyl. So it's still in phase 1B and 2 trial, so it's not out there. But I imagine I would use it as an emergency physician, someone who comes in you know, with methamphetamine poisoning, very high from it, with either physical or mental health side effects, and you give them this sequestrant, and, you know, within minutes, there's no more meth in your body. Wow. As an addiction psychiatrist, do you see a way, if, you know, again, there are trials to be had, but if there was such a thing, would it apply to your patients?
Well, it sounds like an intervention a little bit like, you know, opioid overdose reversal agents like naloxone that would be used in extreme emergency situations.
Or to cleanse your body. If you're trying to, I was thinking maybe if you're entering treatment or rehab and you want to get the stuff out of your body faster than regular metabolism, maybe you'd get a head start on your mental health treatment.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I've not read any of those studies. I've not heard of this drug. One of the things I would wonder about is if the use of it would plunge people into a kind of severe precipitated withdrawal where they would experience intense dysphoria that might make it, you know, something that they would not want to use, but rather, you know, experience the gradual dissipation of it out of their body. But I don't know. Those are, it's not, you know, we need more tools.
Yeah.
So exploring more tools, crafting really good methodologically sound studies that are unbiased to explore those tools is something that I'm in favor of.
Dr. Anna Lemke, thank you so much for your time, your information, your books, your advocacy. It was great to see you on a press release for the Prop 36 Homeless Addiction and Theft Act. I think we both talked about that. I was very excited to see you on that. And continue to, there's a lot of work to be done. Not just, we use our patients to know what needs to be fixed in the world, I feel. And I see that you do that. I do that as well.
Yeah, well, great. Thank you. It's been nice talking to you. A little bit spicy, which I enjoyed.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Physicians for Healthy Communities. Visit physiciansforhealthycommunities.org and view their video and resource library. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.